Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine this, you're stranded on an island, forever. But don't freak out because you get to bring one dish with you, your desert island dish. What is it?
Every week your hosts, Paul and Tegan, that's us.
Hello.
Will ask this question. They'll chat with and torment a literal raft of guests on the island who'll dish up stories, gossip and culinary secrets.
But they all have one big thing in common, they bloody love food.
Welcome to Dish Island. Hello and welcome to another episode of Dish Island. I'm Paul Verhoeven and that right there is Tegan Higginbotham.
And Paul?
Yes?
It's beginning.
What, the end of the world?
No, Paul. It's beginning to...
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, we watched Dante's Peak recently and we're watching a lot of disaster films. And when you said it's beginning, I thought, what, the Tremors?
Gosh, Paul, it's almost like you've been living through a pandemic for the past 2 years.
I am deeply traumatized. But the only thing that's really pulling me through, and I can tell by the light in your eyes that it's for you as well, is the fact that Christmas is coming.
And I'm actually into it this year. Last year, it felt different. I don't know, I was struggling to embrace the Christmas spirit, but this year I've got the spirit all up in the house.
I can't imagine why you were a little bit bummed last year, but this feels like a proper Christmas. There's a real vibe in the air.
I'm already planning Christmas dinner, or I should say Christmas dinners, because we're going to be doing two this year.
Yep.
And we're having those conversations. I've got my wrapping paper colour theme sorted out. I'm going with a pastel pink.
Lovely.
And a nice green, and I'm matching that with a brown paper, so it's got a kind of deconstructed, I don't know, it's really nice.
Oh, the people's paper.
It's the people's paper.
Yep.
I'm leaning in. So, Paul, clearly we love Christmas. So much so that we are launching a mini Christmas series called The 12 Days of Dishmas starting on the 1st of December. But no matter how much we love it, we will never compare to today's guest. He is Christmas through and through. Maybe he's Santa. Knowing his workload, it would not surprise me.
It would explain why he's so tired all the time.
No, I think that's just because he operates in the food industry.
So does Santa, in a way, you know. And he does seem to have a lot of elves around. Anyway, Santa or no, today's guest is a pastry chef, an author, and a dessert warlock. He was head pastry chef at Vue du Monde, and now he and his wife and business partner Kath Claring Bold run the acclaimed Birch & Purchase Sweet Studio. He's also got the record for setting the most pressure tests on MasterChef ever, and is renowned for making said tests as cruel and impossible as he can, which might be why he's so much fun to watch. And as mentioned by Tegan, he is also Santa Claus. Please give it up for the incandescent Darren Purchase. Welcome to Dish Island, Darren. Now, it's almost Christmas time, so we thought we would kick off by asking you, like a dessert warlock, what do you regard as the quintessential Christmas dish?
Well, that's interesting that you're asking me. I love Christmas, and I get my tree up really early every year. And I'm not ashamed to say that, especially the last couple of years, you know, it's been a bit rubbish. So any excuse for a bit of joy, get that tree up. And this year it was up on the 31st of October.
No!
Yeah, well, first draft, always adding a few bits to it. And I'm pretty happy with it right now. It's twinkling away. So, do love Christmas. And I guess Christmas is all about food. Certainly for me as well, you know, obviously family, friends, getting together, food is a massive part of that. You know, being from the UK, food over there is a lot different to food over this side of the world, especially at Christmas time. I think my experience tells me the lack of anything fresh in the Northern Hemisphere in December, in winter, is probably a testament to the sort of food they eat over there. The food that you get to eat in the UK at Christmas time is stuff that's going to keep you alive, keep you warm, and keep you keep it warm. so certainly I'd never had a mango at Christmas until I came to Australia. I'd never had sort of, you know, fresh fruits, berries, you know, pavlova was something that was the most exotic thing I'd ever heard of. So when I came to Australia, I was fully, you know, embraced the fresh food and the completely change of cuisine. I do love Christmas pudding. I love traditions at Christmas, but, you know, give me fresh food, give me mangoes, give me cherries, give me raspberries, you know, give me that any day, any year. I love it. So I guess for me, a pavlova really says sort of Christmas to me. Obviously, I'm a dessert chef. I cook savory as well, but I'm leaning towards dessert answers all the time, I guess. And a passion fruit and mango pavlova is, that's what I think of in my head when I think Christmas now. And if you'd have asked me that before I moved to Australia, it would have been a totally different answer. But I'm really in love with, you know, the pav and the sort of fresh and cool flavors of Christmas over here. Obviously seafood as well.
Are you one of these British people? Because we've got a few friends out from the UK and they bloody love it down here, which is nice. But when Paul and I went to the UK and had Christmas over there, we went, oh, finally, this is what Christmas is meant to be. We think Christmas here is shit, but you, sounds like you're a bit of a fan of an Aussie style Christmas.
Yeah, I am. I'm very much so. You know, my memories of Christmas, obviously, are from my childhood being back in the UK. They're some of the best memories of, you know, my family life. I'm very fortunate. I was brought up with, you know, my mum and dad and my sister. We lived in the south of England, just south of London. So we lived in a nice part of the world. And, you know, I had a great upbringing, great childhood. You know, we weren't rich, but I certainly never went for anything. So when I think back to the UK, my fondest memories in my family are Christmas time. It was always a big deal. Mum still makes a big deal of it now. She's messaging me the whole time, you know, what can I send you. I'm saying, leave it, you know, let's save it for experiences, or, you know, it's pointless sending stuff these days all over the world. You know, my favorite memories are of Christmas in the UK. It was such a fantastic time. But I tell you what, if I had to make the choice, I love cooking in my shorts. There you go. There's a confession. So, I mean, I love cooking full stop, but I've got the full chef gear on when I'm at work, you know, and I do lots of different stuff. But as soon as I get home, Kath laughs her head off, my wife, Kath. I kick off my shoes and I get my shorts on. And if I'm by the barbecue with a pair of shorts on and just enjoying, you know, beautiful weather outside, then that's me in my element. It's kind of like I've cooked all day, but I come home and do like my cooking for me, I guess. So yeah, anything where I can cook my shorts on. So barbecues and social events, sort of outside cooking is where it's at. And Christmas really is where you can really do that, I guess.
Oh, I'm thrilled that the shorts stay on. I thought we had another naked chef on our hands. But so you came over here to Australia, and in the past, what's it been, 10 or 15 years or so, you've just built this huge empire, so much so that when you see a dessert now that's one of your desserts, you just know it's one of your desserts, and I love that. But I was reading through your Christmas menu for this year of all the desserts, and one just summed you up so well, which was this, the bake-at-home mince pies are amazing, but you've got this big pie, but it's got ready-baked brownie. So I guess it's your bake-at-home brownie. It includes ready-baked brownie, chocolate covering, salted caramel, honeycomb, freeze-dried berries, vanilla marshmallow, gingerbread pieces, gold crispy pearls, chocolate shards, fun chocolate Christmas garnish on top. I mean, that is just so you in that it's everything without the kitchen sink. I mean, holy shit, Darren.
Yeah, that's my loaded brownie. So, you know, it's one of the most popular items. So, you know, it's fantastic. It's got everything on there. And, it comes with a little video. So I'm kind of making it, and then you can copy me and kind of do the whole thing. And this sort of stemmed from, I guess, you know, what's been happening the last couple of years, COVID and stuff. You know, it completely changed my business and changed certain things on my menu. And I had to adapt. And, you know, we all say the word pivot. I guess I had to pivot. And I came up with this range of stuff that people make at home. And it's like, what have I been doing my whole life? I've been training to make all these awesome dishes, but now I can literally I just give them the recipe and they make it at home. So who knew a chef could work from home? And that's something I discovered during lockdown. So I've been really excited to change my life, and I create all these new dishes or all these new ideas, and then kind of Cass films me making them at home, and we post the video, and then they can kind of buy the bits from me and then get creative in the kitchen. So it really is a win-win for everyone, because everyone loves to kind of make things, everyone loves to cook, or a lot of people love to cook, or the idea of creating something amazing for their friends and family. But I try and make it absolutely foolproof. So even though there's a bit of cooking involved, you're pretty much going to get the same result with me if you follow the steps and all the bits are there. So it's really fun. And yeah, you know, it's a talking point, and it gets people around the table and just loving each other and loving food and loving Christmas.
I think that's really positive, Darren, but I am slightly concerned that you might be training people to cook your... I mean, will they need you if they can cook your dishes perfectly? Or do you leave out a key ingredient? Like some...
Do you know what? I'd never do that. When I was a young chef, it was like, you know, pre-internet. I'm not a dinosaur, but, you know, we didn't have smartphones and stuff. And really, trying to find out about different food and different chefs around the world, you had to go and buy the cookbook. And a lot of chefs then, they deliberately put wrong stuff in their cookbook because they were they're so scared of, you know, someone replicating what they did, or, you know, they've been guarding this recipe their whole life. And a lot of, like, top name chefs as well. And I won't say any, but I only discovered it in later life when, you know, I knew how to make things myself. And then I thought, you know, I'll go back and find that recipe and see if, it's wrong. And I kind of know that some of it was mistakes, but a lot of the time in the past, chefs would kind of guard stuff. But I'm kind of from the generation, or I have the mindset of absolutely give everything away. And number one, you can kind of take ownership, especially now with the internet. You know, if you give something away and someone references you, then it's kind of there forever. Mm. And also, you want people to succeed, but also you don't want to be making the same things yourself the whole time. And it pushes you to create new stuff. So everyone else is making the last thing that you've given them. Then it's like, well, what am I going to make? I'm going to have to come up with something brand new, or I'm going to have to experiment with this. So for me, I just want to pass on all that information. So my cookbooks and my recipes that I post online, and they're 100% bang on. If there's any mistakes, they're administration mistakes, because I do it all myself. But I do love that people make my stuff and make recipes and then post and say, you know, Darren purchased recipe, it works really well, and my family loved it, and, you know, everyone really enjoyed it, and now it's become a tradition. We make it every year, and then they post stuff, and that stuff is what it's all about for me. And I sit, you know, with Kath at home, and we flick through our phone, and we check what people have made, and it just makes us feel really great. And, you know, that's what it's all about, I reckon. Don't guard it, don't keep it a secret. Let's put it out there so everyone can enjoy it.
We've tried several of your recipes and they're incredible. I buggered one up, but that was my fault, I think. But here's a question. Talking about giving things away, I got to do one of your masterclasses for the Basque cheesecake, which you have now become a bit famous for.
Yeah.
And I did it with a friend of mine, and the class was great. She's made it twice since, and it's been the most delicious thing we've ever had. But we have a very important question. So during this masterclass, you took us through how to make, I think it was, two different cheesecakes. You had several other mini cheesecakes already there prepped from earlier. There was another one going in the oven, I think. And my big question to you is, where did all those cheesecakes go? Because you said you were going to eat them, and I think you might have, and I have so much respect if you did.
Do you know what? I gave it a good crack. We got through a few of them. Don't think that I'm one of those chefs who, I don't eat my own stuff, or you know, one of those pastry chefs where I don't eat sugar, you know. No, we get stuck in. But there was quite a lot. So we take it to work because the guys love it. But there's also, I'm living in an apartment at the moment in Paran, and there's a cafe downstairs. And whenever I go in there, I think they know who I am a little bit sometimes, and they give me like free coffees and stuff. And I always feel bad because I'll go down there because I want to support sort of local business. And So now there's this thing where the guy who owns it, he gives me a free coffee all the time, and it's awesome, and I just think it's really special. So whenever I make stuff, and I'm making stuff all the time in my apartment, so I'm doing all these classes here, then I send it downstairs to the cafe and distribute it to those guys as well. So I'm always looking for someone that I can give something away to. So yeah, it does get distributed, but I do give it a good crack myself, I must admit.
I have a confession to make, Darren. I was chatting with Kath afterwards, just going, "Hey, that was a really great class. Hey, what are you doing with all that cheesecake?"
Did you really? That's what the hell, Paul.
If you don't ask,
you must stop.
I didn't realise. It would have been on its way to you. You got to be a bit more forceful. Because the subtlety's lost on me. It's like, "Darren, give me the cheesecake."
Hang on. So you're telling me if I'd said, "Darren, I want that cheesecake," you would have probably... No, the thing is, I feel like... Look, I often say this. I often think Tegan's very subtle. If she wants something, she will give off signals. But I've said to her, "You're being too subtle. Just ask for the thing."
I'm not asking for cheesecake,
no,
Paul.
You're asking with your eyes, okay? Lusting for this cheesecake.
Oh, gosh.
Darren, you said something a little while back that I want to circle back to very quickly. You mentioned Christmas trees. Let's first of all enjoy the fact that you set your Christmas trees up very early. I have two questions. One, do you decorate the thing the whole way around? As in, do you have the back of it that looks kind of pathetic that's against the wall, or do you do a full 360? And secondly, what day is it acceptable to take the tree down? Because Tegan almost wants to burn the thing the day after Christmas.
Right, I'm an expert on both of those questions. I do all the way around because it's currently situated, the front of my tree at the moment, I'm looking at it, it looks awesome. But the back is actually facing a window, and I'm in an apartment, first floor apartment, and I have to decorate the back because I don't want anyone to think that I'm one of those ones who only does a half a job. And also, I want to spread the Christmas cheer around the neighbourhood as well. So for sure, definitely the back has been done. It's quite a big tree. So we did stuff on the back and then pushed it towards the window in position and then put the marquee stuff on the front. But we've got quite a lot of decorations that we've collected over the years. So, and we're always adding to it. I find that it could even be like a couple of days before we take it down that it's like, "Oh, you know, let's just put that one on there as well because we've got more than we need." But I'm very flamboyant in my tree decorating. I'm like the Elton John of Christmas tree decorators. So it's pretty out there. But I like to think it's tasteful, but, yeah, Kath won't let me go too far. You know, she'll say, "Back up, step away from the tree, Darren." Like I do with cakes. So I'm like, or desserts. I'm kind of like finishing something, and you know, she thinks it's done, and I can't stop. I keep adding stuff. She's like, "Step away from the cake." I go, okay, sorry. She's like the voice of reason. But in terms of bringing the tree down, although I love tradition, Christmas, I don't adhere to the traditional 12 days of Christmas. My dad would be mortified if he knew that the tree was coming down too early. You know, they kind of do the whole 12th night thing and, you know, bring it down the right day, otherwise the whole world's going to end. But what we do around here is we get it up early and we also use it as propping for any food shots that we want to take with a Christmas tree in the background. So that's another reason why it goes up early.
Great.
We can get a bit of Christmas content going. And it actually comes down on the day of New Year's Eve. So we spend the day, carefully packing it away. And it does take a while. We've got the last of the Christmas music going. And then we kind of ease into sort of the evening, which will be, we'll either go to a restaurant or it'll be sort of me cooking or me and Kath cooking, and it'll be things like prawns and stuff, and we'll go into the new year with a really sort of clean house and a clean space, and you know, we'll talk that evening about what we want to achieve in the next year, and we'll kind of put Christmas to bed. The tree goes away on New Year's Eve, so that's our little thing. It makes us feel great waking up New Year's Day, trying to go for a walk around the town and then getting into the new year and trying to achieve all the things that we want to achieve.
I love that, actually. I think there's really beautiful symbolism there. I've got to ask, you've mentioned Kath a few times now. Birch and Purchase really did start from these two love stories. It's your love of dessert and also the love story between you and Kath, because it started when you both met in Brisbane. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. Kath looked like she's the hidden one. So she doesn't like the limelight or any sort of attention being brought on her. She's quite an introverted person.
And she's going to hate this.
Well, she doesn't mind being spoken about, I guess, but it's very rare you'll see her in a photo. You know, you'll have to do a bit of a Google. She always manages to find a reason to take the shot instead of being in the shot. But, you know, that's an admirable quality compared to, you know, me on the other hand, I'm like, you know, get me in there. You know, where's the camera? I guess we make a good match. Contrastingly, we make a good match. But yeah, I met Kath. For some of your listeners will know, if listening to a food podcast, that she was quite a celebrated chef a while ago, and she had lots of restaurants in Melbourne and interstate. She was known for her sort of Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cuisine, and she was opening a restaurant in Brisbane just, I think, in 2004, when I was invited to go to Brisbane sort of food festival to present. I was invited from London. There was an Australian chef who was due to present, and he didn't have a passport. He didn't have the visa correct, so he couldn't return to his own country because he'd lived in the UK. And I was like a last minute replacement. I was, my executive chef was a last minute replacement. And he said, I'm bringing Darren because I'm bagged for fun. And also, you know, I'll get the job done. I'll crack out all the mise en place while he's sort of swanning around. yeah, we came over and I was like, what is this place? This is incredible. You know, the weather was amazing. I was introduced to all these sort of chefs. I was introduced to Kath at a cocktail party, and she hates these things. And she's like, I think it was me, actually. I said, you know, do you want to get out of here? Because I could see she's uncomfortable. And we just ended up spending, you know, the next sort of 4 or 5 days together. And it was really special. And I organized a trip to Noosa after the food festival. And before I was due to fly back to London, and I got up there and Kath was up there. She had organized a couple of days. So we spent another couple of days.
Wow.
So it was awesome. It's really awesome. And I went, long story short, I went back to London. I said, that's it. I met a girl. I'm moving to Australia. And they all said, wow, you know, like what happened over there? So it took me about 12 months to finally arrive in Australia permanently. In that 12 months, Kath visited me in the UK and had a holiday, and, you know, went out to restaurants and got to know each other a bit more. And then we had a bit more of a relationship, you know, through email and stuff like that. I don't think we had FaceTime then. I arrived in Melbourne and I think it was raining. I said, what is this place? This isn't Brisbane.
What a letdown.
It's England.
Yeah. Where's Brisbane? Where's Queensland? Where's the sun? And she's like, this is Melbourne. It's a bit like UK. And I was like, oh, right, okay. No, it was awesome. Arrived in Melbourne and I didn't know anything about Australian food, Australian cuisine, Australian restaurants or chefs. I didn't really know anything. And she threw me the good food guide and said, you better get a job. And I thought, right, well, I'll open it and start at the top, work my way down. But I was very lucky enough to get a job at the number one restaurant at the time. So I went to go and see Shannon Bennett, and I worked at Vue du Monde, and that was my first introduction to the Melbourne food scene, around about 2005, working at Vue du Monde for a few years. And it was awesome. So I got to meet loads of people, and it really kind of set the tone for my future career in Melbourne. Yeah.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Amazing. I am currently reading Down and Out in Paris and London by George Orwell, which I know is a pretty strange different direction to go in. But it sounds like, you know, the way he depicts the food industry, it's pretty brutal and it's pretty hard.
Yeah.
And all we've heard about throughout COVID over the past year is that the hard industry got even harder. But you and Kath seems to have weathered this storm together and not only survived, but, you know, every time Paul and I walk past your sweet studio, you guys are just run off your feet busy because there's just so much success there. I mean, that must be, it must be, first of all, just such a hard balance dealing with all of that in the world. But then as a couple, you know, you guys working together throughout all that, it must have been very stressful.
It is stressful, but it's also a strength working with your partner who you get on really well with all the time. We're very lucky. Obviously, that in times of, you know, depressive times, that's a real strength. So we draw strength from each other, and we look after each other at home and at work. But yeah, you know, I don't want to dwell too much on the COVID thing. It's like it was hard for everyone, and in different ways. And obviously, it was hard for us. But we have managed to sort of find a path through it. Successfully, but you know, we're quite flexible and we're quite you know, inventive, and we're prepared to make big decisions quite quickly and not look back. So that's kind of what we did at Sweet Studio. We said, right, straight away, we're not a shop anymore, we're an online store, click and collect, you drive through around the back, you pre-order, we'll cut the you know, the business hours down from 5 days, from 7 days to five, so we can keep the same team on the same roster, and we try and look after everyone here and continue what we're doing and navigate through this. You know, we were deemed as an essential service, like a food business, so we kind of kept open and we're making kegs, and people, even in like terrible times and also financially restricted times, they still want like a little bit of luxury, and everyone wants a birthday cake. So we managed to work our way through it and also refine our business model at the same time, which was really exciting, because we've finally got something now that is kind of where we wanted to be, but we may not have got here had COVID not hit. And I'm not saying I'm thankful for COVID, but I'm saying that, you know, we've managed to get to where, closer to where we need to be, probably quicker than we would have done. It's interesting you said that book, George Orwell. I used to read that book a long time ago, because I started out as a dishwasher, or a plongeur, he called it, in France. And yeah, it's a very interesting book on, you know, not only life in kitchens, but also, you know, like an assessment of poverty, having money and not having money. It's really awesome. So it's interesting you mentioned that, because I did start out washing dishes a very long time ago, and I think that washing dishes, working in kitchens or working in hospitality, I listened to your one with Julia Zemira earlier, and she was saying that being a waitress really helped her in her sort of later life of, you know, presenting and maybe broadcasting or entertaining. I do believe that jobs in the kitchen or his hospitality, waitressing, help you not only in Julia Zemira's career, but just in life in general, dealing with different people, working under pressure, you know, navigating different situations. I think it really does sort of help. And I would encourage anyone to, you know, be a waiter or waitress, and or work in a kitchen, even if it's just for a little while, just so you can see different personalities and how you can, you know, navigate your future self. I think it teaches you very good skills.
Yeah, when I was 15, it was time to do work experience at school, and we had a regular kind of cafe restaurant we went to, and I got work experience as a dish pig, basically. And I think what they got was free labor, but I ended up working there for about 2 years, just, cleaning dishes and being a kitchen hand. And I wanted to be a chef, and there was a point where I dropped out of high school in year 10, and I was seriously considering going and getting into the industry and becoming an actual chef. And I regret that I didn't on a weekly basis, especially now during lockdown when...
Do you really? Do you actually think now about a career in food?
Well, you know how much I love cooking.
I know. I didn't think that you were thinking about it in those terms, though.
No, I mean, I think it would have brought out a lot of things in my personality that would have been really odd. I mean, Darren, you seem borderline saint-like at this point, but you don't seem quite so bubbly and friendly when you are torturing MasterChef contestants with just these insane challenges. I mean, do you have that side in you that likes to kind of mess with people?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I do. I love, I'm just being careful of what I say here. I know this is being recorded and it can get brought up in the future. You know, I've worked in crazy kitchens before. I've worked in toxic environments, and I worked in places where it was, I mean, and also in a time where it was kind of the norm. And I'm thankful that we're now out of that sort of period in cooking. Although I probably wouldn't change my some of the stuff I've done in the past in terms of where I worked and some of the stuff I put up with, because I think it's formed me as a person and as a chef. But not necessarily everything that I've experienced in kitchens is a good thing. And do you know what? There was a lot of time wasted in kitchens back then as well. You know, a lot of repetitive stuff. So I regret that more than getting my ass kicked by a chef. Because usually if you get your ass kicked, it's because you've done something wrong. And in those times, you know, it was the done thing. And, you know, I'm not saying that that's right. And it's definitely not right. But I personally think I deserve a kick up the ass if I do something wrong, because it means I won't. I'll remember it and I won't do it again. But I guess some of the stuff I regret in past kitchens is doing the same job over and over again. It was like there were so many chefs and so many, you know, staff that were available to places then. I worked in a big hotel and there was 125 chefs. So often you'd be doing like a repetitive task over and over again for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's like, I don't need to do it. I know how to do it now, but basically you were just a cog in a wheel.
Yeah.
So I regret some of the time that I've lost because I feel like I could have achieved more, but I don't regret some of the crazy experiences. But I'm thankful we're now through that. And I'm thankful now I get to appear regularly on a TV show that is so positive and so all about food. And so, so life-changing for some people. I know it sounds a bit, you know, I don't want to sound, you know, non-genuine, but it is life-changing for some people. And I do really enjoy going on there and encouraging as well as setting a crazy task or challenge. But, with those challenges, it's nothing that cannot be done. You know, I work my way back. They say, right, can you set a pressure test? You know, I'll sort of say, you know, is there any ingredient you want me to use? You know, because I don't know the context of the season that far, you know, but maybe I'm coming up with a dish that's coconut and last week is coconut and coconut the week before. Mm-hmm. So I kind of ask for, I'm experienced enough now, I've been on the show a while, to ask for sort of tips, you know, do you want me to use, what do you want me to use? And then I kind of come up with the hardest dish possible and I make it myself. And I time myself and I try and get it. And then I just try and refine that recipe back. I try and tweak it back so that someone could finish it in 2 hours. That's the first question I ask them when they ask me to make a pressure test. How long have the contestants got? And basically, I come up with a dish that goes right to that second.
Oh.
Because although I know how to cook and I'm running around and I know, you know, so I've got that advantage. The contestants do have the advantage of having the recipe in front of them. So this is MasterChef after all. So you've got to know how to cook. So I kind of make it right to that minute. And the worst pressure tests are the ones where no one gets anything right. The best ones are where all four of them complete a dish, feel a sense of accomplishment. There's drama at the end because everyone's plating right at the last minute. But even though someone sadly usually goes home on a pressure test, everyone feels like they've learned something. And, I think that's what makes a good pressure test. So I think I've set more pressure tests than anyone in the history of MasterChef. So
oh, wow.
I think I know what I'm talking about. But, it's fun. And I just love being part of something that's very positive. I hate it when they have to go on, but it's a great show.
It is. We've just absolutely loved. We're currently watching the season of Celebrity MasterChef, and that's a whole lot of fun too. It does make me feel really bad about my skills at home, but that's okay. But Darren, we know you have to run off soon. So just before we find out what your non-Christmas, your actual just official Desert Island dish is, I've got one other question, and it is going to put you on the spot a bit because this is a big one. It's going to go on the record. But I know that you are a huge Doctor Who fan. It is one of the things that we have bonded with over the years. So once and for all, just for all the other fans out there, because I know there are a few who listen, do you have a favourite Doctor?
Of course I do. But it's got to be generational, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, Tom Baker for me is like the Doctor Who. But it's probably because of the my age at that time, I really can't remember Patrick Troughton too much, or just, you know, prior to that, although I knew it was on. The ones that really stand out in my head where I'm behind the sofa, Mum saying, "Get up, Darren, it's only makeup." I mean, when you look back at the episodes now, it's just ridiculous. Like, was I scared of that? But Tom Baker was the one. And, you know, I remember Peter Davison really well because I remember he had the cricket sweatshirt on, and Colin Baker as well. They were like the great times of me watching Doctor Who. I still love the show, and I support Jodie in her role as well. I think she's awesome. So all the Jodie haters out there, sort yourselves out. I just think she's great, and I think Doctor Who can be anyone or anything. You know, like the whole gender thing is crazy. You know, the it's an alien with two hearts. So it can look and be anything. And I think that's what the appeal of Doctor Who is. I always loved the regeneration episodes. I actually had a photo shoot of me. We recreated the TARDIS in, I don't want to sound sad, like a nerdy sad nerd. But we recreated a Doctor Who scene in the Sweet Studio, and we had a TARDIS there, and I had some liquid nitrogen inside the TARDIS, and it was kind of like creating this like ethereal smoke, and I kind of the picture was me coming out of the TARDIS with this space age dessert in my hand, and we did that for an art exhibition for the Melbourne Film and Arts Festival a long time ago, and it's one of my favorite photos. I think it's my first ever Instagram, and curiously enough, I think I've been on Instagram for quite a while, and I hadn't thought of that photo again. And then you know when you get you look at your Instagram, you see someone's liked a photo from ages ago, and you go, "Who's doing that? What's going on there?" Then I don't want to name drop too much here, but I thought it was really weird because Matt Lucas, who you will know, obviously, yes, was on Doctor Who, liked my Doctor Who photo about 2 weeks ago.
Oh my God!
Yeah, seriously. And it must have been years ago that I posted that. And it's like, I do know him a little bit, but we're not like best mates or anything. But, you know, how did he find that? Was he searching hashtag Doctor Who? Was he, you know, was he just having a bit of a play around and then saw it and then liked it? I don't know. But I just thought it was really awesome that someone from the show liked my Doctor Who picture, even though it was about sort of 10 years too late. They still went on there and found it in the end. So that was awesome. Yeah, we do love Doctor Who. I've always thought that I'm no actor, obviously, but If I could choose, even though I've done an episode of Neighbours, and I think you have as well, Tegan.
Yeah, but you had a better role on Neighbours, trust me.
I would like to be in Doctor Who in the background somewhere, doing something, Neighbours and something in James Bond, and then that would be me, that's my acting career over. I guess that's probably what most actors would want to do. But that would do me. Just a bit part.
For a man who doesn't think he's a Whovian or doesn't want to be referred to as a Whovian, that is one of the nerdiest bits that I've heard. That is definitely the nerdiest spiel that we've had on this show. But
I don't want to come off as a nerd, but here's 4 minutes of why I'm a huge nerd.
No, that was completely opposite. I was trying to be pally with you two because I know you like Doctor Who. I'm like, oh, what would they like me to say?
It's all lies.
It's all fake. It's all fake. But look, I think, okay, so we really need to get to the kind of the crux of the reason you're here. You're stranded on this island with us and you can only bring one dish with you. Now, given you are the king of desserts, I guess the assumption is that you're bringing dessert. But, I mean, what is your desert island dish?
Yeah, I thought long and hard about this. And also, you know, I've listened to a couple of previous ones, so I didn't want to repeat anything. And I know you've had Heinle's chicken twice. I could easily choose that because it's one of my favourite dishes, but I don't have the history attached to it, I guess. And I probably can't explain it as well as Melissa Leong, and I probably can't cook it as well as Adam Liao. So we'll leave that. But, you know, would it be a dessert? I don't think so. I guess going back to the start of the show, I'm in my shorts. We're outside, we're cooking together, and I've got loads of people there. So this has got, you know, I think of this question as a chef. I go, right, how many people are we serving? What are the dietaries? So I'm going to choose a Spanish paella. And you might think that's a bit crazy for the pastry chef guy, but I do cook savory. My wife cooks a mean paella. It's one of our fondest things that we think back on and remember. She cooked one in Spain once. We went traveling in Spain and we took our own knives and tea towels abroad with us because you never know when you're going to get a blunt knife or a crappy tea towel that doesn't absorb anything. So we always travel with those things because we love to cook in overseas. And she cooked like an awesome paella, and we cook it often ever since. But this is a dish where everyone can kind of stand around. We can all have a bit of a drink beforehand, you know, maybe a couple of coconuts beforehand. I'm in my shorts. We're all telling a few stories. I know someone else has bought dessert. I'm getting to know some of the people that I don't know who are on the island. And it's kind of a social event because I'm thinking this island doesn't have a lot of infrastructure. So dinner time might be, you know, the highlight of the day. We've all been out and done a bit of hunting or whatever you do on an island, but we get together at the end of the day and swap stories and come together as a community. And I reckon a big kind of flame of paella, and I'm cooking away. And we're chucking different stuff in there. So paella traditionalists will tell you, you know, you can't put chorizo in paella, or, you know, traditional paella Valencia will have you know, rabbit and snails in. But with a paella, really, because we're from Australia and we love to take dishes from overseas and make them our own and do whatever we want, because we can kind of do that because we've never had the food history to start off with. We rely on people coming over here and showing us dishes and then we make them our own. We're just chucking in whatever we got. So, you know, Darmian's just done a bit of spear fishing and she's caught some snapper. You know, Georgia Love is just, you know, she's chucking in some native herbs or whatever. We're all just kind of chucking stuff in there. We're cooking it together and we're enjoying it together. And I think that's really what food's all about. And although that's not a dish that I'm known for, I reckon it's a dish that I could eat again and again because you can kind of tweak it with whatever you got and it will keep everyone happy. And that's what it's all about, I reckon. What do you think of that?
Not only is that a staggering answer, Darren, it's the only answer that has made me want to be on this island. You're the only person who has painted some weird utopian picture where we're all kind of swanning around. There's no war. There's no infighting with Celia's army. It just sounds chill as
it
heck.
It does. I know we probably shouldn't take sides, but I think that is my favourite answer of the season. Oh. That's amazing.
Well, Darren, thank you so much for joining us on Dish Island. I cannot stress enough how much of a pleasure it is to have you here.
Pleasure. It's my absolute pleasure. I listen to this podcast all the time, so it's an honour to be on here with so many awesome people, and it's good to know you too as well.
Tegan, we now have two Darrens on the island, and I don't know which one is sweeter.
Oh, Paul. Oh, Paul, you sweetheart. Wasn't that just the most fantastic chat?
Yeah, I learned a lot about him. And also, I'm still not convinced he's not Santa.
No, I know. We're going to have to keep a real close eye on him on Christmas Eve. But we just want to say, look, as a special little add-on, Paul and I have actually sampled Darren's Yule log, mm-hmm. which now that I say it
sounds
out loud.
Super rude.
It's really rude.
Yep.
But it's amazing. And I know for a fact that Birch and Purchase are only doing a very limited run of all of their Christmas treats this year. So I do implore you to get online and put in your orders nice and early.
So what's in Darren's enormous log?
Stop it. I'm not going into the details of Darren's log, but what I will tell you is that there are mince pies, which you can bake at home, ham jam, which also, I don't know.
Hang on, what's ham jam?
I don't know, but it also sounds rude. I don't know what's happening with this list. The loaded festive brownie, which we spoke about before. There's lots of stuff, so you should get online. But here's the really exciting thing I want to talk about, which is that this Sunday, Darren is doing a Lamingtons and Lemon Tart Masterclass online, 2 p.m. on Sunday, the 28th of November. Tickets are still available, although I think they are close to selling out. But I know that Paul and I are going. We're going to sit there and try and figure out how to nail a lemon tart even close to what Darren can. But you really should come along, because in the lead up to Christmas, you're going to have people over. You want to impress them. Mm. Get your treat game down.
The thing about Darren is, when I say he's a dessert warlock, I'm not joking. He makes the most incredible things. He has an amazing eye for detail. And what's great about a Darren Purchase creation is nothing else looks like it. No. So if you head along to this masterclass, you're going to learn some of his amazing tips and tricks. And also, you're probably going to get to meet Kath.
Paul?
Yeah?
This is the last episode for our Dish Island season.
Yeah.
For 2021.
It feels very odd and sort of bittersweet, but as mentioned at the start of the episode, we've got something very, very special in store to kind of make it up to you.
From the 1st to the 12th of December, we are going to be hosting a very special Christmas mini-series where every day for the 12 days of Dishmas...
Every day.
Every day.
Every frigging day.
So sorry, Paul.
That's okay.
But every single day, we're going to be releasing a mini-episode with tips and incredible Christmas stories from more wonderful, wonderful guests. It's just going to be a lot of bloody Christmassy fun.
That's right. And we'll be asking our guests all kinds of Christmas related stuff, including the pressing question, what their desert island Christmas dish is.
Which I've realised is exactly what Bill Nighy does in Love Actually, where we've just changed one word to make it a Christmas series.
Yeah, so it's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of work, so make sure you listen. Seriously, it's like an advent calendar, a Christmassy audio advent calendar. Every single morning for the first 12 days of December, a brand new Christmas episode right up in your stocking.
You shouldn't say that things are up in things.
But sometimes they are.
Like you said before, get a Yule log up you, and that's upsetting.
But it's so tasty. I love Darren's log.
Stop it.
Anyway, thank you so much for listening to not just this episode of Dish Island, but this season of Dish Island. We have had so much fun with you. And remember, socks don't count as presents. So kids, if you get anything practical, ask for a refund. I'm not joking.
Stop it.
Socks aren't presents.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Dish Island.
Dish Island is a proud member of the Acast Creator Network.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.